Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2021, and I'm now here with Vico Hesler. Now, this, I have to say, is one of the streams that I have looked forward to the most in Millennial this year, because it was all started when I read an article on Countercurrents in March this year called How the Coronavirus Took Over the World, and I've linked to it below, so you can please have a look at that. And I decided right there, I want this guy on Millennial because this is a fascinating. I'm gonna sing his praises, and I hope I don't embarrass him too much with praise. But I thought it was an outstanding piece of work and fascinating to read. So, Vico, welcome to Millennial.
Hi there, great to be here, and thanks for that introduction. I think I'm here by personal rather than popular demand. I don't think many people out there will be entirely familiar with me, but hello, everyone.
Okay, so I guess we should we could riff off the article. We probably will here and there, but do you want to talk about your own background first, or you know, interesting?
Yeah,
in
sure. So I think that people might be familiar with me more from Countercurrents, writing for the Warden Post. I've been in the ethno-nationalist movement for about 15 years, but I've mostly been writing since 2015. So some of those articles have been turned into pieces. For example, there was a piece on General Lee that was picked up by Vertigo Politics. That was quite a popular YouTube video, and that statue, unfortunately, now is being melted down. But I tend to view myself more as a kind of copyright-free fly poster on the internet, really, where I'm happy to see the work picked up.
Right, okay. And you do have your own website that people...
Yes, all the articles are available at transcendental-titans.net.
Okay, and that's linked below as well. All right, so let's get to COVID, and this is going to be largely about COVID and the right's response to COVID. How would you describe the world as it was in 2019? What would you say the salient things were about the world that we should have picked up on at the time and realised we're going to be relevant very soon, and things that changed?
Well, I think that COVID's primarily a sociological process, and you've got to view it within the context, you know, larger context, really. If you looked at how things were developing, particularly with the sort of medical authoritarianism that was nascent at that time, even, you know, you looked at the kind of opioid crisis and how the Sackler family was involved in that, you could see there was a lot of groundwork laid for what was to come, especially because the kind of ostracization that has occurred in this period, what the groundwork was laid then. Once certain subjects became taboo, you know, once we had this polarized era of what I like to term chronic politics, vis-a-vis Brexit and all those kind of things, you know, they'd already kind of laid the psychic groundwork for this. And I think also one of the salient features is the world is already becoming more and more digitized. So I think you wouldn't have been able to enact these lockdowns, you know, in the 80s or 90s, because people were so much more face to face. Whereas now we live in our own echo chambers. We're so digitized and atomized that for a lot of people, fundamentally, the world hasn't changed without access to the real world. You know, they live in their echo chambers, and social signaling has become a kind of totem pole, you know, feature that where people climb up via doing that. So I actually think that, you know, that this wouldn't have been possible in 10 years before.
I think even 10 years before, indeed. I know that in the 70s, there were futurologists talking about the office of the future. Well, the paper, it will be paperless, but also there will be far more people working from home. And they were saying this would be the case in like 20 years from then, so the 90s. Of course, they were out by quite a wee while, but not that much. And they were saying,
well,
20 years.
Yes, we're gone. Sorry to cut you off there, but it's interesting to note that what I've noticed about the kind of the UK approach to COVID is they're still allowing people to work in certain industries. So you've got telemarketers, and, you know, the fact that they haven't made it a legal requirement to work from home kind of shows that it's about control, not about COVID as a deadly disease as such. For example, if you actually have COVID and you look at the amount of money that you're paid for your time for having COVID, it's paltry compared to all these furloughs and things that they've been handing out. So you have to kind of question really whether what the intent is here. So you've still got industries that are working out there, but they've particularly targeted hospitality and events industries because, as I say, these are things that you do in the tactile real world. I think they've still kept a lot of these non-jobs on the back burner, really.
Would you say that it's largely about changing culture and lifestyle rather than anything else?
I'd say it's a mechanism for control, really. I mean, it's just kind of they enacted the groundwork for this kind of thing before by, you know, ostracizing certain people, particularly on the right, as non-persons. And so they've just expanded that policy. In the latest article I wrote on Countercurrents and the Long Winter of Liberty, the term that I used was they've created new categories of deniers. So, you know, we've got the science denier, the climate change denier, and they just come along with new categories of denier. And then you're unpersoned by the commissariat.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the COVID denier. That's certainly a new category they've invented, a new way to demonize people. It's and of course, the word denier relies on the Holocaust denier.
Yeah, exactly right. That's the point that I made there in the article, that that they are evoking that kind of, you know, that was the initial subject where they made this big taboo, and then they're, you know, using that to evoke that, you know, deliberately in people's minds.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's kind of like secondhand or transferred guilt. Because they've established that to deny the Holocaust, like if you deny the Holocaust or whatever, then you're a denier of that thing. And to be a denier of that thing is awful. And now we can just transfer the word denier to other issues, and the same emotional weight will carry over. So if you're a COVID denier, that is effectively as bad as being a Holocaust denier. I remember people moaning about this with climate change denier 15 years ago, saying it was disgusting to trivialize the Holocaust by using that phrase regarding climate change. But of course, it happens. It keeps happening. So the groundwork for this was laid beforehand. And this is the thing that I think a lot of people hadn't grasped, and I hadn't grasped it. Is it something that occurred to you at the time, or only in retrospect did you realize that how much was already in place to do something like what we've seen over the last 2 years?
I think the groundwork had been laid a long time ago, really. If you looked at the trends, people were, as I say, being digitized, moving towards these kind of things. And I mean, if you look at the kind of groundwork that was laid in terms of, as you say, in vilifying people, that we live in an era of chronic politics, so this was all laid out before, really. And I think if you saw the writing on the wall, then this was obviously going to be done, and it was a test run for the future endeavors that they've got planned.
What do you mean by we live in an era of chronic politics?
So this is a term that I used to describe things like, for example, the Brexit and this coronavirus pandemic, where it's ongoing, it goes on for years, and nothing. There's something acute that's happened that we're responding to. It just goes on and on.
Right. I think you mentioned this in a subsequent article that I read, where you said that, or maybe it was in this one actually, that things just drag on. They become narratives. They become sort of soap operas. An issue, a political issue, is not dealt with and then moved on from. It's like the Russia narrative, for example, with Donald Trump. It just went on and on and on when it long after it should have been over. But of course, that was so because it was useful to the powers that be. And I think it's the same with COVID. It's the same with Brexit. They've exploded Brexit into this indictment of, you know, modern Britain. You know, modern Britain is a racist country because it voted for Brexit. And I guess that with COVID, obviously, it is in the interests of certain powers that be, that the public believe COVID is an extremely dangerous threat. What would you say about this using of a disease to achieve control? It seems quite a novel, but in retrospect, a very obvious tactic.
Well, I think the biggest thing is that the NHS had always sort of reached this rock star status. I think the apogee of it was where people were out clapping for the NHS. So they'd already kind of laid the groundwork to set up this medical dictatorship, which depended on, I think the deeper causes are because we live in this secular society and the doctors are basically the new priest class, which enables them to make these pontifications. You look at Fauci or people like that, and they're kind of making their commandments from the mountaintops, which aren't questioned. You know, they're just accepted as dogma, really.
Well, yeah, the NHS has become a... Is it, people used to say this, and I generally support the idea of a socialized medical care. I think it's as good a solution and it's as flawed a solution as any other, but it does at least mean...
I think people get bogged down in the distinction between private and public healthcare, but they don't accept the fact that the NHS already was a lie in the sense that the outcomes that it has for most patients, if you've actually used it, aren't great. You know, it's overhyped. It's become a kind of victim of its own success. And as I say, behind that, the big pharma elements had gone unchecked for years. You look at, you know, as I say, the Sackler family's role in the opioid crisis and the complicity of doctors in that. And you can see, you know, if you look at Pfizer's record, for example, these companies which we're now praising as saviors because they're the vaccine providers are actually, you know, quite infamous in their own right.
Well, absolutely. And of course, you know, Anthony Fauci now is a bizarre, a very strange figure. I guess this is part of elevating scientists to, you know, a priestly class that you really can't question. This is a point that I made quite, I think maybe the last year, that the ideal dogma or the ideal ethical fabric, or I don't know what you would say here, a sort of theological fabric for an elite class is one that the masses cannot question, that they cannot even comprehend. They can't even begin to question it because they don't understand it. And so dense theology is one option there because
it's analogous to the, you know, Latin mass where you don't understand these things, but it's trust the science, TM, and go on with it.
It gives this
thing a kind of neo-religious aspect because we live in this secular society where there's no metaphysical basis on which to oppose what's happening, really. So we've instead, because in a society where living the longest is the only life goal, then, you know, it's natural that it falls to this priestly doctor class. You look back in history and doctors were regarded, you know, surgeons and of that ilk were regarded as pretty much scum. But now we, in the absence of God, then we have changed.
Well, exactly. And a similar thing now is that you had dense theology that baffles people and also by baffling them sort of reassures them. I think there's also a certain humane element to this because a good elite know and understand and accept that the masses don't really want to understand things. They just want to be looked after. They want to be kept safe. So there's actually a certain pragmatism, accepting of the human condition in all of this. But the replacement for dense theology is dense science. It's stuff that no one person can read all of the literature about the respiratory system. I mean, that's just, I'm sure you could spend your entire life and reading about this and still not know everything that there is to know about the human respiratory system.
It's a function of the hyperpolarized society, isn't it? Where these things are just tacked on. So you're pro-vaccine, you're pro-remain, and they just kind of string on the new theology with new kind of holy ghosts and bells and whistles, really. And that you have these two implacable camps. So yeah, there is that element. And as you say, there's no way in which you could ever check this science, and the science is obviously funded by the vested interests, and if you question it, then you're deplatformed immediately. So it's very analogous to that.
I think, yeah, functionally it is. It seems to function the same way. It baffles people. They don't know what to make of it, so they default to just respecting authority. And, you know, I'm sure that many of us will have got into arguments with friends, colleagues, neighbours, relatives, and the other person has said to you, do you really think you know better than all of these doctors and scientists? And it would sound crazy for you to say, yes, I think I haven't done the reading, I haven't done the degrees and all of the medical lectures that they've attended. I haven't done any of that, but and yet I think I know better than them. And so that's how they get you. That's how we arrive at this consensus that everyone should just trust the science.
Yeah, because, it's because we've endowed doctors, as I say, with this kind of neo-religious infallibility, which they don't have, obviously, if you looked into any of kind of even outside of the realms of COVID. You look at modern medical advances, there's a lot of work in the field of medical nihilism where a lot of it's bogus. It's just biosimilars and pumped out for big pharma to make money, and they're in the pocket of that. So, you know, it's kind of an infirm class to draw your morality from. There's a strange kind of neurotic post-Soviet element to this COVID pandemic where the commissariat just kind of decides what the new thing is. So, you know, it's double mass today or booster tomorrow. You just get your diktats from on top and that's your new talking point.
Well, indeed. And this is something that I think a lot of people were taken aback by. I think we had this notion that in the West, we live in democracies and we live in societies where there's free inquiry. And we live in societies where each individual is encouraged to manifest himself and whatever. And so it's been a real surprise for a lot of people to see that most people are very accepting of a consensus from above.
I don't think most people are very interested in democracy, to be honest with you. I think if you had a consensus today on whether we should have perpetual lockdown, you'd probably still get a 60% vote. So,
yeah,
it's kind of not that surprising to me in a sense.
No, indeed. This is sort of what I was saying earlier, that people just want to be looked after. I think the masses, that's basically what they want. I don't want to be condescending about them. And I'm not even judging them for it. If this is true about the human condition, then we just have to accept it. There's no point feeling superior to them. It's just the way they are.
We accepted this one party statehood with the fact that you have these votes on coronavirus and you have one party that's in favor of them and one party that's even more in favor of them. Yes. You have these kind of North Korean style press conferences from Boris where you get the approved questions that say, why don't we have more restrictions? And then you have this kind of North Korean style outburst of clapping for the NHS. It's all very odd to me.
Well, the NHS has, as we were saying, it's become elevated, but it's now become, it's almost like it is the patient and we've all got to look after it.
Well, this is a strange thing. It's the perfect subject for that because they say the NHS isn't fully funded, but the NHS can never be fully funded by virtue of what it is. So, you know, it's this endless kind of Soviet monolith that they've elevated to this heroic status. And then if you actually speak to anyone that's had any interaction with it, they've usually had a bad outcome with it. But everyone has to pretend that it's this, you know, heroic thing. I'm not saying, of course, that everyone in that system is bad, but I'm saying that the outcomes for that system for a lot of people are quite bad. And we have this kind of fallacy where we say it's the world-beating healthcare system, apart from the fact that it closes down every winter and is overwhelmed and, you know, it's staffed entirely by kind of this immigration class. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have to say I had a lot of good experiences with the NHS in Scotland, but in England, not so much. It is a mixed bag. It really does depend on...
It's very ad hoc. I mean, you can have a good encounter or a bad encounter, but I don't think that's something we can say the new theology. We have to clap applaudingly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it depends on the area you're living in for obvious reasons. And also it depends on the culture of the hospital, like the leadership, the management of each individual hospital. I think that has a huge effect. Let's go to the essay, because I wanted to read out some bits of it. The truth may be that the coronavirus did not blink into existence in Wuhan 1 year ago. Remember, this is written in March this year. Rather,
unfortunately, it's still going.
Yeah, rather, it had been incubating in the psyche of modern societies for years. The ease with which populations not only acquiesced to governmental restrictions, but also willfully demanded more of them, is proof that we had already accepted the premise of the coronavirus lockdowns into our hearts long ago. And that's very interesting because, again, another thing that I think people would have taken as a given in 2019 is that we all value liberty and freedom, and we don't want restrictions on those things. And restrictions on those things are taken as aberrations and outrageous, but not really. This really surprised me.
I think the trend towards, I mean, if you look at the trend of liberty, we've continually lost liberties along the way. And in the most recent article, I mentioned that, Western countries, we traded away our liberty on demographics and in immigration for this kind of laissez-faire economic progress. And once we'd accepted that premise, then, you know, you're opening yourself up to trade away a lot more liberties, which is a process that we have done. But we've lost many liberties along the way, and no one's really opposed it. And I think that's what's encouraged the political class, because when we do have these debates about liberty, it tends to be the case that they're lost.
Yeah, yeah. I think in the end, we can't find a way to justify liberty, because it always relies on, it's a trade-off between liberty and safety. And we're all about safety these days. This whole thing with online censorship, they've now attached the word safety to it. And not only with the online safety bill in Britain, but in America with the Facebook whistleblower, when she was being interviewed, and I'm certain that this was all faked, I'm certain that it was all put up, she kept using the word safety. She kept accusing Facebook of prioritizing profit over safety. That word is emphasized again and again. And you could say this is to do with the feminization of our societies. I think there is a binary there. I think masculine love of liberty is on one side and feminine love of safety on the other. I think that is a thing. But obviously it's not quite that simple. Another quote from your article: it's worth noting that almost all the trends and changes that the coronavirus has seemingly unleashed are simply an acceleration of what was pre-existing. Atomization, a retreat from the physical world into the digital, a neurotic collective hysteria in the face of death without a spiritual framework, the expectation that the government will provide, and a pseudo-religious belief in experts and scientific redemption, and the hyper-politicization of communal activity. Now, there's so much just in that. You've already talked about atomization. You've already talked about hysteria about death, when, you know, health is the only thing left to believe in, absent religion. The expectation that the government will provide. Now, this has been a bugbear of right-wingers for decades and decades. But would you like to give your own 21st century perspective on that, the expectation that the government will provide?
Well, I think we're moving towards the total state. Most modern work is completely pointless anyway. So, and if we've already accepted the premise that large segments of the population are essentially welfare dependent, then we may as well do away with work. And I think this kind of intermingles with this hickamore mentality where people are all in their room all the time anyway, so we may as well just, you know, and the fiat money printing that's occurred. So I think we are moving towards a totalized state where, you know, everyone will just be allotted an income and it will go on.
So this is UBI. I wanted some people to appear on Millennial this year who would be able to talk about UBI, but unfortunately none of them said yes.
I think it fell out of vogue after the Yang campaign.
I remember it being mentioned. It was a certain topic when I first started in 2013, 14. There were some channels in what was called the Reactosphere who were talking about UBI as a future prospect. And I think they imagined that it would be decades down the line, 50 years down the line, that we would have to think about this, that it would become a possibility. In actual fact, it's only 8 years later that we seem to be, and as you say, Andrew Yang talked about it, but I think that what he was talking about was a fairly sort of unadventurous idea. I think that with the system that's now coming in, or seems to be coming in with the Great Reset, it's a much more elaborate and sophisticated, that's an entirely new economy, really. Now, what you were saying earlier about how most jobs are pointless, I think that's true. I think that a lot of stuff, as we know, it can be automated, can be algorithms, robots. It doesn't matter anymore. And the production methods are so efficient now that we don't need people doing the manual jobs that used to be done. Obviously, agriculture is the story of agriculture is the story of ever greater efficiency, such that hardly anyone needs to be involved in it now, human beings. But that goes for these other things as well, including what we used to think of as quite cerebral professions.
I think it's just the quest for efficiency, though. If you look at most jobs, I mean, capitalism, the lie is modern capitalism is hyper efficient, but you have all these non-jobs and, you know, governmental jobs, and even, you know, I think the majority of jobs that people do, especially if they're in marketing, telemarketing, all these kind of jobs are fundamentally redundant, really. They're kind of just they are a kind of de facto UBI in the sense they don't, a lot of governmental jobs don't produce any value.
Yeah.
Well, you have this whole Equality and Human Rights Commission, for example, that, you know, is a billion pounds, for example. That's just every company has their kind of diversity commissar. And, you know, but even more fundamentally than that, you know, a lot of these jobs, because they had to create an artificial demand in the labor market to facilitate the entrance of women and migrants and lots of other things, that there's a whole host of pointless jobs now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Make work. Again, this has been a bugbear of conservatives for quite a long time, but I think they didn't realize how correct they actually were about it. It's only becoming apparent now that so much of, I mean, look what's happened over the last year, or the last 2 years. Lockdowns, lots of people have just gone home, and yet the world has kept ticking over. And a lot of people will not have noticed really any difference at all in the provision of food.
Well, I think this trend started in the 2008 financial crash, where the banks were allowed to continue. And then once we'd crossed that Rubicon that we'd accepted in modern capitalism, there's the freedom not to fail. We kind of trickled that down to everyone where, you know, we can furlough people indefinitely. We can print more money. We seem to be carrying on in a strange fiat world that, you know, the S&P 500 gets higher despite the fact that we're all sat inside.
Well, what I was going to say about UBI is if you've watched Catherine Austin Fitz being interviewed, she seems to talk about a new economy where it's simply not about profit anymore. And you see this with huge corporations making products that don't turn a profit. They're not interested. Presumably they've got so much money already that they just don't need to worry about profit. But also it's worth it for them to even make a loss because it gets them power. It gets them cultural and political and social power. So it's not really, it's something that I can't understand. It's something that I don't know.
Well, the corporations, the big pharma and the government are basically what I call kind of iron triangle these days, where it doesn't, as you say, it doesn't really matter. All their profits are in junk stock anyway. So, you know, they can float an insane valuation and get these seed capitalists and carry on without ever turning a profit. I mean, YouTube was unprofitable for many years and still carried on somehow.
Yeah, of course, because it had Google funding it. I believe it's still unprofitable. I'm not sure about that. The other thing is that hedge funds...
They've got rid of you now, so they're clearly in profit.
the hedge funds, BlackRock, and so on, that seems to be how things are actually funded now. A lot of stuff is not expected to turn a profit. It's expected to be of use to these massive financial providers. This is my understanding of it. Again, I might well be mistaken, but either way, the world that, you know, there's the famous meme that the world that you were raised for no longer exists. The world that we thought we were living in, a lot of us, most of us in 2019, is in the process of being dismantled, dissolved. And part of this is, coronavirus. The COVID has been used as the public pretext for doing these things, the public pretext for this process. So that would be, you know, UBI and again, I don't know if that would be administered by a government or by a corporation that's got some sort of deal with a government. I don't know. That's yet to unfold. Another thing you mentioned was a pseudo-religious belief in experts. I think we've gone into that already. And scientific redemption, which I guess is interesting in itself, because if you, again, I think of the Kaiser Chiefs talking about the vaccine at that concert, and people are, you know.
Well, I think it's a transhumanist fixation, isn't it? Where people genuinely believe that we're going to advance this situation where, you know, it's part of this new carte blanche human mentality where we have transsexuals, and, you know, no one talks about the fact that the surgeries that they undergo aren't really, you know, producing what they claim to. We have this kind of transhumanist belief that we're moving towards this society where we can have interchangeable charts, you know, parts, and be whatever we want to be. But in reality, as I say, the medical science hasn't caught up with that. We don't have an instance, really, as far as I know, where you would willingly opt to have a medical surgery to replace any conventional body part. You know, it's just still a hype.
We're still pre-opt.
the unaugmented students,
scientific redemption. I think that being vaccinated
the immune system is software as service, and I think that's kind of apt, really, where they are signed up to the COVID immunity, which, despite the fact that we have an all-time high of cases, people are rushing out to get the vaccine, which hasn't been explained to me how it can be concurrent that we have an all-time high of cases, yet, you know, we have this hugely vaccinated population.
Well, again, this is another part of it, that people don't care about the contradictions.
I think if anything, it makes them irrational and angry. If you made that statement, they'd come up with a million justifications for why that is the case without ever really, you know, if they were honest with themselves, considering that.
Yeah. I think this is something that I've noticed with intelligent people, is that they will find a way to make it all make sense. They'll actually paper over the contradictions themselves manually.
Well, Frodi Midgiel has this term, the Eeyore-ite, which is kind of intelligence with misanthropic characteristics, and there's kind of an Eeyore left where they use their intelligence to justify this ridiculousness.
Yeah. And then the final thing you mentioned was the hyper-politicization of communal activity. What did you mean by that?
So I think, as I say, that there's these hyper-polarized groups that you belong to. You're kind of part of these camps now, aren't you, where you just add on the next facet of whatever the camp is. So you're pro-mask, you're pro-booster, you're pro-remain, you're pro-electric car, and it just splits along those lines, really, and it's become the red-blue football team situation, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. It does. I've said myself, everything has become politicized now. Everything is seen as crucial, and also as a moral issue. Politics has merged with morals. It seems incredible now to think that once upon a time, people didn't really judge each other on their politics.
Yeah, there's no capacity to agree to disagree anymore. It's absolutely totalizing politics, where, you know, you make some mild transgression and you're depersoned and thrown out of the party, never to be seen again.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't have the correct opinion about LGBT, about feminism,
well, they're literally this massive framework of legal repression that they've put into place. So it's not only just a value judgment, it's literally legal.
Yeah. I can imagine people being fired for saying the wrong thing about climate change. If that isn't already the case, I think it will be in the near future.
Well, I think climate change, as I mentioned in my latest article, you know, we had this massive pandemic, yet they took the time out for this COP26 climate change conference where they were deciding what vehicle you can drive, what kind of heating you can have, and all these kind of aspects to it. So, you know, the coronavirus will merge into whatever the next, perhaps the climate change crisis, you know, it's just a dry run for whatever next round of repression we've decided on.
Yeah. Okay, there's another point in your article. In examining COVID as a social display rather than as a deadly viral outbreak, it is useful to identify who has consistently resisted the lockdown. Primarily religious communities within the West have continued their lives largely unhindered, Only a few weeks ago, the Orthodox Jewish stronghold of Stamford Hill in London had the highest rate of COVID in the UK. Likewise, there have been several high-profile cases of Indian and Pakistani weddings and religious festivals being broken up. And it is disproportionately high COVID rates in Bradford and Leicester, which are very diverse cities in Britain. Now, it is popular on the right to point to this as an example of the failure of multiculturalism, highlighting, as it does, that immigrant communities do not abide by the laws of the land, and that governments are too timid to enforce them in case of fearing accusations of racism. These points are, of course, true, but this also says more about Western host societies than it does about those who have migrated to them. What did you mean by that last point?
I think there's a timidity in the West, this fear of death, this secular society that we live in, where there's no metaphysical value over and above your own life. You just value your life by the amount of years you live. It's telling because the average mortality of COVID is beyond the average life expectancy. So people are they're cowering. I think it's an inability to accept that your parents and your grandparents are going to die. Because we don't have any framework to deal with that anymore. We don't have any consoling church. We don't have any kind of metaphysical basis. I think the left and a lot of these COVID supporters are basically powered by a kind of neurosis that they're going to die at some point. And that's why it's tapped into it so successfully, because all that they have is their hedonistic, consumeristic life. They try and shut out this Heideggerian authentic thoughts. They try and shut out any kind of metaphysical introspection. They just want to carry on with their lives and their consuming, and they don't want to think about it. And the people who bring it up upset them deeply, and that's why they react so badly to it.
Yeah, you went into this later on. The shrill cries of moral indignation about the selfishness of killing grandma have much less weight if you have already accepted that your grandparents will die and that you will too. In a world riven by suffering and temporal chaos, the religious minorities have opted to make meaningful lives rather than to potentially live just that little bit longer in the self-imposed cryostasis of Western societies. It's a very interesting, very nice paragraph there. Would you like to expand on it?
Well, I think that this whole COVID crisis is really a kind of risk assessment, and it's a kind of value. What are you valuing in your life? I would rather live a life that's meaningful. I'd rather meet my friends. I'd rather go out and do things. And, you know, I'd rather accept the fact if I cross a street and I'm going to be hit by a car, then, you know, the day of my death is written. I'd rather go out there and live a life in the years that I have. We've waited 2 years. The biggest robbery of this government is it's robbed everyone of their time. That's the biggest thing that a government could ever rob you of, not your money, not anything like that. And that's why I'm so opposed to this thing. You know, all the people that have missed saying goodbye to their parents, they've missed weddings, you know, we've broken with the cycle of life, whereas the people who are metaphysically inclined, they keep to those rhythms. So they celebrate births, weddings, you know, funerals, and they haven't really succumbed to this strange, arbitrary, technocratic government mandates that we have, because they're more in tune with the perennial cycle than we are, whereas we're hiding in our living rooms, clapping the NHS, hoping that the next UBI check is coming along. I think there's an inherent kind of timidity in the West that's not something to be admired, for sure.
Yeah, we're frightened to die, but also frightened to live, ironically. It's a very perverse situation.
Well, if you look at Gen Z, I mean, they're mostly taking Xanax in their room, not going out. They're obsessed with gender identities and stuff that comes from Twitter. They don't congregate and kind of go through the same rites of passage that we have. You know, they live entirely this digitized life, so if the access to the real world is cut off, they don't care. And that's why they've targeted hospitality. That's why they've targeted events, because they're trying to cut out these places where people can meet and talk freely. That's why they've deplatformed people, because if you have an atomized population that gets all its information from the internet, it's much more docile and much more susceptible to these malleable ideas.
Much more. I mean, you could talk about that all night, the implications of that. If people are just... and I remember people saying this, I think I said it as well, but it was a common thing when the smoking ban came
in. People and yourself, yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember if it was something I read or came up with myself. That's what I mean. It was in this, when the smoking ban came in 2006-07, people were saying, this is one of the communal things. The pub is the center of community, and so it's interesting that the government doesn't care about the how this is going to affect pubs. Now, obviously, you might be against smoking. You might be.
Well, it's totally illegal now in New Zealand, which is also one of the biggest COVID dictatorships. So it's, I think these strangely, you know.
Oh, there are parallels.
Yeah, what you might call the unnecessary liberty is sometimes the most necessary liberty. You know, I want to be able to, you know, explore these things. And that was once they made those arguments for, oh, well, you can't smoke, there's passive smoke, and, you know, you might endanger people. That was kind of a proto framework for what's come now. You might not believe it so, but it is in a way.
Yeah. I think that it was, in various ways, the smoking ban seems like a prototype for what we've seen with COVID, because it was justified on the basis that you are endangering other people's health with your lifestyle choice, and your liberty should end where their safety begins.
Well, they also brought in the NHS argument again, even though the fact that smokers were net tax beneficiaries to the NHS. So they were a burden on the NHS, even though the fact that they were paying over the odds to use the service.
Oh, I mean, the vast majority of the cost of a packet of cigarettes was tax. They were making a fortune in tax. And I've said this, and, you know, I'm not evangelical about smoking, and I don't smoke anymore. You know,
it's not pro-smoking. It's just that we're pro the choice of people to have these liberties. And once these liberties are taken away, they're not replaced. And that's the kind of the issue you have. You know, you lose a small battle, which is, oh, well, I won't have smoking anymore. And next news, we're locked inside for 2 years.
Exactly. One thing does lead to another. So I was actually right to be outraged as I was in 2007, because
when I was growing up, I kind of considered it a bit of a peripheral, you know, boomer tier issue. But do see the kind of, it's the meme where there's the dominoes coming.
yeah. And at the time, even I, like most of the people of my own age, weren't smoking. So, and they were saying to me, look, what's the big deal? Get over it and all this. But it felt like such an assault on dignity to have this choice taken away from you. It's sort of a humiliation. But where was I going to go with this? They were saying that there was some aspect of this that you brought up, and it reminded me of. It was a reduction of liberty on the basis of public safety. And that was it. And the government didn't seem to care about the social implications that it would have. And because loads of people would go to the pub and they would stay in there for hours. This was a sort of standard thing in Britain and no doubt everywhere else, that men would go to pubs, have heated discussions, all sorts of different topics, and they wouldn't step outside again until 5 hours later. But the smoking ban meant that you had to always step outside, like every 20 minutes, to have a cigarette, which meant that a lot of people just decided, I can't be bothered with it, especially when you're in Scotland and it's bloody cold in December. No one wanted to do that. So what happened was they didn't go to the pub, and as a result, loads of pubs closed down. The rate of pub closures massively increased after the smoking ban came in. It just decimated that industry. And you know, you'd get pubs up and down the country that had been there for centuries that just disappeared. And so you've got these community hubs, these hot points of communal activity that were simply deleted. And so that brings us back to this world now, 15 years later, where we are encouraged to stay at home. Like the smoker 15 years ago was encouraged or nudged into just stay at home, get some beers from the supermarket. You don't need to go to the pub, and you can do what you like in your living room. And so they did. But that did away with all the social interaction. And I think that, again, that brings us one step closer to where we are now.
I think you've kind of got to understand that the government hates pubs. They hate these things, firstly, because it's implicitly associated with the the native culture that they think is a puddle to be stepped out of, and secondarily because people can meet and discuss freely, so it's not incidental that they've done these things.
Yeah, you've got to wonder if it is all organized, orchestrated, or if not, then it's definitely coincidentally beneficial to them. So someone's written, the government hates pubs because that's where you go to speak a little treason. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are probably, in every pub in every country, every day, there's probably someone saying, the politician should be hanged.
I think they're a bit scared of it as well, because I went to a Brexit party rally at one point that had 100,000 people in Birmingham, and there was getting people like Tim Martin, I think the founder of Wetherspoons, were kind of gaining a pseudo popularity based on this. So I think there's a real kind of tangible threat to the government from these things.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, we'll move on to another quote from your essay. The transition, and this is a totally different aspect of the whole thing, the transition from a government of oligarchic middle managers, which I think is accurate, I think that's a good characterization of what we had in the 2000s, the 2010s, and even the 1990s, a government of oligarchic middle managers to total domination by an unelected scientific cabal, was really not that drastic when politics had already been reduced to nothing more than a rationalistic and utilitarian problem-solving exercise. And indeed, you wonder, why can't it just be done with algorithms at this point? If that's all they're doing, it's really just working out the most efficient way to enact this policy directive, which has come from above, then the job of the politician is greatly diminished.
It could be, but they're operating on false ontological assumptions, so everything that they do is wrong. So because they're starting from the premise of their ideology first and imposing that on reality rather than imposing reality on their assumptions. So obviously this is why you get these articles that AI is racist, for example. So they could run things through a technocratic machine, but it's the old quote that the only thing that saves us from the bureaucracy is its own inefficiency. But in this case, it's its own ideological blindness that saves us, because they start with these insane assumptions about the world. And when assumptions don't mask, then they don't amend their methodology. They just try and force it by legal means.
Yeah, indeed. The only thing that political parties seem to agree on disagree on is whether the restrictions are tough enough, and if the logistics of policing and vaccination have been sufficiently draconian. I remember laughing out loud at that phrasing. But we are in this position where that is the only... And Dave Cullen has done a lot of videos making this point, that the only debate is whether we should be doing more. It's never whether we should be doing less. And they pay lip service to this because they know that the public sometimes want less to be done. They want to be able to cuddle granny at Christmas. So sometimes they go into that, but it's never that's never the point. It's never the sort of goal to maximize liberty. It's always, could we justify reducing liberty further?
Well, I think it was kind of summarised by Keir Starmer coming out and saying the government's motion to implement COVID vaccine passes never would have passed without our support, as if that was some sort of achievement, whereas an opposition, maybe called me old-fashioned, was meant to oppose what the government was doing, not help them initiate their policies.
Well, yeah, I can't even imagine what it would... Well, then again, I was going to say I can't imagine what it would have been like if Labour had been in power. But the thing is, probably wouldn't have, because I was thinking it's probably be even worse, but really no, it'd probably be just the same, because I think that whether Boris Johnson's in the Prime Minister or Keir Starmer, they're going to be just following orders, aren't they? I mean, again, Boris Johnson said that he's just following orders. He actually said that he's just following orders.
Well, they are. I mean, you can see this in the fact that all governments are basically in lockstep. I mean, the strange thing about the COVID pandemic is the uniformity of the adoption of it. I mean, it's kind of like Jack Donovan's Empire of Nothing, if you've ever read his book, where we can't even... One of the depressing things about the whole COVID pandemic is you can't really escape to some other country where the restrictions don't exist. Even in Eastern Europe, you've seen these insane policies in Latvia and Lithuania and the Baltic, where you can't even go and buy bread if you don't have a COVID pass, you know, so it's not a case that there's places where there's more liberty. It's just across the board.
Yeah. Okay, to move on to another part from your essay. All of this illustrates one fundamental realization. The incentive structures, and this is, you were saying that people are in no rush, the public are in no rush to return to normality, because normality for them was simply social isolation and alienation, with additional demands placed upon them. What does the outside world offer to these people anymore? The answer for an increasing number of people is soulless, unnecessary, and unfulfilling corporate jobs in an atomized world where no one around you looks like you, set amid the backdrop of interchangeable towns and cities. Now, this is obviously a very depressing summary, but I think it is quite accurate increasingly. And so for that reason, it was actually preferable for a lot of people to be in lockdown. And I remember people celebrating it at first. And really, the only thing they did miss was socializing with their friends, and going to clubs, you know, going to festivals and whatever. But not really the opportunity to make something of themselves, because, and this was what I really liked about your essay. It sort of pointed out that the opportunity to make something of yourself had already dissolved.
There's no social mobility in the modern world anyway. You're never going to be part of these global elites, and that's a preserve of a very few people. And there's been an overproduction of elites, so that's why they've created all these non-jobs for these fantastic amount of university graduates that sit around doing nothing. So you've kind of not lost anything. No one cares about going to the office. You're not, you know, you don't care about the people there particularly. As you say, they might care about protecting, you know, their festival or perhaps their friendship group, but they can just, you know, substitute that via Zoom or whatever. So for a lot of people, they kind of would happily live in this perpetual lockdown where if they didn't have to go back to their jobs, they'd probably accept the UBI and carry on voting for the government, especially if they're intimidated by the fact that they might be killed by this 0.1% virus.
Okay. And so a lot of people weren't bothered about lockdown. And then you went on, all of this illustrates one fundamental realization. The incentive structures of Western societies have drastically changed over the past few decades. Wealth acquisition, because again, you know, when I was growing up, people were always moaning, the left were always moaning about all anyone cares about is profit and getting rich.
Well, they've rigged the game to such a point where you're as a young person today, you're never going to own a home, really. If you're in a, you know, in the south of England or these areas, it's not a realistic goal. So If you accept that these prestige things, whether it's a home or a family or whatever, aren't going to happen, then to a degree, like, you've got this property market in the UK and in Canada and America that's run away to a point where it's unaffordable for most people. So no matter how hard you work, it doesn't really matter in the end, does it?
Hmm. So that negates wealth acquisition as a life goal. And then you listed passing on your genes to the next generation. That used to be an incentive for people to, you know, get out and about. What would you say about that? The incentive structure, passing on your genes to the next generation?
Well, I think it's a combination of, you've got the climate change cult that has kind of enabled people to say, I'm child free and have a moral standing to it. So it's not just, oh, I want to engage in my hedonistic lifestyle. There's a moral kind of card that you can play where that the status now is to be child free. If you have a big family, you know, you look down upon and they'll write hit pieces on you about how you're killing the planet. So, I mean, Elon Musk came out the other day and said that we should have more children, and that seemed to rustle the media. So,
yeah. And then the other one was, and gaining social standing in the local community. You're saying that that is no longer something that people care to do.
Well, I don't think most people even have a local community to speak of. I think if you're so atomized to the point that you can, there's no church, you know, the pub that was, it's probably closed and is a chain pub if there is anything at all. If you're in certain areas of the UK, the local community has absolutely nothing in common to you anyway, doesn't want to speak to you. So, you know, there is no local community to appeal to anyway.
Right. And I think also a lot of people feel that they do have a local community, and it is their race, it's their same ethnic group, but nonetheless they feel outside of it. They feel that they don't have anything in common with it. Okay, and then these incentives of wealth acquisition, passing on your genes, and gaining social standing, have been replaced by virtue signaling and climbing the ladder of social clout in the global digital community, getting likes, getting followers, getting subscribers. So would you talk about that briefly, virtue signaling and climbing the ladder of social clout?
Well, I think there was a fundamental change in social media when it moved away from being a medium to associate with your friends to this kind of sinister thing where you had followers. And that's a very telling word, because once you have followers, you kind of grow this following. And you know, all movements now are based around these kind of micro and macro celebrity individual personalities that have a following, and you're either in that following or not. It's not based around any kind of communal, you know, it's not based around political parties really, or community associations. It's based around individual narcissism. And so that's been one of the transitions where you build up your follower base, and that's how we operate in society. And an easy way to gain a follower base, especially in modern world, is to virtue signal about these things, because it reassures people that are, you know, wavering, you know, oh, maybe this isn't a good idea, this whole 2-year lockdown. And then they see their influencers saying, you know, get your third booster or you're killing everyone.
Yeah, it's actually a vehicle for, as you say, it's a vehicle for encouraging conformity and groupthink and passivity.
I think the internet as a whole has kind of narrowed down. When it first started, it was the Wild West. You could reach out to anyone and it was this free space. Whereas now it's, you know, as I say, the real world is the escape from the internet, because it's become all pervasive. All 24-hour news just simply looks at what's on Twitter today, and then they pull something out, some outrage, and that's their talking point for the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people, especially young women, who want to be social media influencers, but they don't mean...
Well, social media conformists, really.
Yeah,
exactly. That's the last thing they do. It's a misnomer, but then everything in modernity is the opposite of what it actually is.
Yeah, well, yeah, what they mean is someone who reinforces, it's not influencing people in a new direction.
They're kind of a pseudo-political commissariat, aren't they? You know, they're a local area, really.
Yeah, it's being the queen bee by conforming to what has already been established. So, yes, it's just so unpleasant.
Well, you can see it every time there's a major event and all the profile pictures and the Instagram pictures change to whatever the trend is of the day. A lot of people don't even really understand what it is. They just kind of change it. And if you question them on what it is or why it is, then they don't really have an answer about it.
No. Okay, to move forward. The fact is, the physical world has lost its grip over the modern imagination. Going out to earn a living is an almost archaic activity when we are inching towards states so all-encompassing that they will provide a UBI driven by fiat money printing. I think we've already talked about that, so we don't really need to go into it now. The rise of Bitcoin is a reaction to the feeling that our economies are a giant fiction, running up debts that are never intended to be repaid, presided over by a handful of oligarchs with more wealth than we could ever even imagine. Under these conditions, heading outside and into the office seems terribly outmoded. Would you like to expand on that?
Well, I think, you know, in your 9-to-5 job, as I say, you're never going to be able to own a house. So we've kind of gone back to this strange 1920s mentality where people are buying NFTs of monkeys in millions of pounds, because the economy is a joke anyway, that none of it means anything. So there's all these articles by the major financial papers that people shouldn't invest in Bitcoin, they shouldn't invest in cryptocurrencies because it's a joke and it doesn't have any resemblance to reality. Yet we're all living in a society where, as I say, we've been locked down for years, yet the S&P and FTSE 100 seem to continue to operate and go up.
Exactly. It's interesting how the you get people like Peter Schiff who say that, you know, Bitcoin is based on nothing. the fiat world is the same. It's actually even worse, because at least Bitcoin is based on everyone collectively having
Bitcoin is finite as well. I mean, you've got the quantitative easing methodology where they're printing more and more money. I mean, you look at Biden's stimulus package.
Exactly.
A recovery package, you know.
Exactly. And it's just dreamed up. It's just money just created from nothing. Whereas Bitcoin actually is a representation of real value, because it represents people, that it represents people's confidence in the currency or lack thereof. So it is actually tied to something that's real, whereas fiat money it really is just nothing. And I think a lot of the boomer generation struggle to understand this, that they imagine that fiat money actually does represent something real and tangible, when it hasn't for a very long time, a very long time indeed. Okay, well, I think that's everything from your article. Now, you also wanted to talk about the right's reaction to COVID. So what would you say about that? Obviously, there was initially, there were people who wanted an authoritarian response to it.
I think certain elements of the right have misunderstood the purpose, really. I said earlier that there was, before the show, that there was a commentary on Countercurrents that said that they worship authority. I think that's the wrong attitude to approach. I can see why they've come to this conclusion. They're obviously, they're channeling the tree of tradition, and they're trying to respect institutions as they are. But we must understand that the tree of tradition has got a lot of rotten roots these days, and you don't have to accept authority wholesale at all. I mean, especially in these times. So there's certain people in the right that say if we'd lock down like China and seal people in, that we'd be out of this now. Whereas it's not an epidemiological phenomenon; it's a sociological phenomenon. So they're kind of misinterpreted the world there.
So I agree with you. I think there was also a naivety about. Well, they imagined that the authorities wouldn't do this by out of malice. This is ironic. I think that there was a certain. It revealed that a lot of right-wingers who are dissidents and see themselves as dissidents actually do retain a certain faith in the powers that be, in the status quo. Because
I think their intellectual kind of grounding is too small for a lot of the right, from what I see. They've kind of shut down, and they have their Schmitt and their Evola and Spengler. And I'm not to say that, these aren't great authors of the time, but they've kind of got their pantheon, and that's their handbook of viewing the world. And they can't view themselves as counterculture or outlaws. They're trying to appeal, they dress in a suit and tie, and they try and appeal to this bourgeois respectability that vanished 20 years ago, when they're outlaws. They're criminalized by every organization on the planet.
So what would you say is a more sane way for these people to view themselves?
I think that we need to foster a kind of right-wing anti-authoritarianism. We kind of need to channel in some ways the counterculture of the 60s and 70s and make it into a neo-right-wing movement. That's a bit of a change of pace for a lot of people, but I don't think we can continue to appeal to this bourgeois respectability where we constantly say, oh, we'll wear a suit and tie and we'll win over the silent majority, because in a lot of cases they aren't there, and we've been criminalized to the degree you can't have a bank account. You can't, run a show like this on a major platform. We need to accept what we are and where we're.
And where we are. Yeah, that's. I haven't thought about this actually for quite some time. I think you might be right. I'm not sure, because you never know where things are going to go. But you're right that the masses. Aren't really. I mean, the masses are never interested in counterculture. They're interested in easy choices and having fun and being ultimately safe.
Well, we are already kind of running it to a degree. In the latest article, I pointed out that the Telegram and the Twitter spaces are a kind of neo-French salon where we're discussing ideas and dangerous ideas and gathering together. So there are these facilities to make that kind of interactions.
Oh yeah. Of course, the authorities want to ban Telegram. I know that in Germany they're really. I think they're about to crack down on it in quite a big way. I think I've heard similar things about France and Sweden and Austria. I'm not sure, but nonetheless, it's there, and Odyssey is there, and individual websites are there. Again, the Countercurrents website is there. I think you're right that we do have to think in cultural terms, because obviously politics is.
Well, I'd say that the problem is I'm not personally very optimistic about any kind of electoral reversal with it. I think that, for example, Patriotic Alternative, I wish them all the best. But if you look at the way that the demographics in this country have changed and look at the way that the legal apparatus has changed since even the BNP, I think that you could win perhaps, local upsets. But there's no political vehicle for that kind of opportunity. I think the objective of ethno-nationalists now is to think post-state and to foster these communities and preserve a nucleus amongst themselves, to think of themselves as nodes that we're interacting here. and reaching out to people. And we kind of are the communities of the day. You know, there's nothing else coming.
Yeah. And I should say, I might as well plug my own community here at this point because it's relevant. There is MW Public on Telegram. That's I used to have a Skype community, but it was a bit anarchic because the facilities on Skype just were not good for.
No, yeah, I suppose they didn't have the management systems in place. Oh,
dreadful. Telegram's a lot better. It could still be quite a lot better still, but you know, nonetheless, it's there and it's. It is a good place, and there are sub forums for different things, vehicles, science fiction, religion, etc. So that is something that people might want to consider. And then there is Academic Agents Community. I think that he's done great work there with community building. So that is something to consider. Okay, I think I'll return to the closing statement of your essay. Our only recourse is to begin to reroot ourselves in a Heideggerian authentic life, to seek out like-minded individuals and to build robust and resilient communities that can thrive in this bleak existential landscape. As others live their lives in stasis, we must instead embrace reality with vigour and work to take it back. Would you like to end by expanding on that slightly?
Well, I think ultimately the reason I set up Transcendental Titans was kind of an appeal and a beacon to reach out to people. And if we accept the premise that we aren't numerically superior, then we have to be better. We have to communicate with each other. We have to set goals in life to try and, you know, transcend the problems of modern life. I think there's too much of a mentality in the right to just point at things and say, that's very bad. Well, you know, the right-wing energy, the successful right-wing movements are kinetic. They're in the real world. You know, they do real-world activities. They meet up with people. I've tried to, in my time in this movement, not only just write about things, but to actually get out there and talk to people and network. So this is kind of my appeal. Every article I've written, I've tried to, I hope at least, have a kind of positive white-pilling outcome to it. There's a pointless to me to write something that's depressing because the whole project that I'm engaged in here is remoralization. I want people to get together and understand that this fight is winnable. I do think that we have to think post-state largely. I think that many Western states are going to be lost and many good things are going to be lost. But we are the pivot generation, as I've put it before, that it all hinges on us now. We're here now in the present. You know, history belongs not only to who show up, but who are here. And no one's coming over the hill with any cavalry. It's up to us to band together. You know, we've got the inspirations of the past and we can do it. We can network together. We've shown ourselves to be resilient. We're here tonight with all the opposition, all the people that don't want us to be here, don't want to hear, you know, what we have to say, and we're still here and we're still fighting. So I think we should get together and we should band together and we should hopefully win this thing.
All right, let's leave it at that. This has been a really good one. It's been quite dystopian. We've really gone into the depths of the problems with the modern world, and
well, it's kind of my problem, a bit of a Cassandra really, but I try, as I say, my fundamental message, I hope, is to people, is that it's not hopeless. I like to outline the situation that we're in, but I don't want people to lose hope. I want them to reach out, and as I say, they can find me at transcendental titans.net, and then, you know, if they want to get involved, then feel free to drop me a line.
Okay, excellent. Well, Vico Hesler, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2021.
Thanks very much for hosting me.
All right, I'll be back in 20 minutes with Black Pilled. Hope you've enjoyed this, or at least, if not enjoyed it, I hope it has been of use to you. I've enjoyed it. I think it's a very interesting subject matter. Again, the essay is linked below. Transcendental Titans is linked below. So please have a look at both of those links. All right, I'll be back soon. Bye bye for now.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the white stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.